Contented Media presents Dr. Bitcoin, the man who wasn't Satoshi Nakamoto, an original podcast series with Mark Hunter and Arthur Van Pelt.
Hello and welcome to Dr. Bitcoin, the man who wasn't Satoshi Nakamoto, and the fourth episode in our bare and uncut coverage of the Cooper versus Craig Wright trial. Last week, we saw forensics experts, cryptocurrency experts, and forgery amateurs take to the stand as the trial came to a quite explosive conclusion. And with me to go through the final action of the match is the man who got more mentions by Craig Wright than Cooper itself. It's Arthur Van Pelt. Arthur, we'll go to it in a bit more detail, but how did you feel getting a couple of name drops in there from the man himself?
Oh, man. It was amazing. No, actually, but because the, several people who were reporting on those indeed two times, to be honest, the first time I missed, the second time because I was talking to somebody else, and the second time I heard and I saw, because I am on the video link, he was directly directing his answers to the judge, to Justice Mellor. And I was like, "Whoa! He just mentioned my name! Wow!" it's a bit of a weird experience, I could tell you. And my feed went bonkers on Twitter after that. A lot of messages, yeah. And people want to notify you that you have been name dropped in a high profile court case. So I was like, "Wow!" Yeah, sort of cool, and of course it has calmed down a little, and we know where it came from. But we will dive into that at the end of this episode, I guess.
Yes, we will. We'll cover that in a lot more detail when we come to what it was Craig Wright was discussing. So in this episode then, we'll cover all the action from the final week of evidence, starting on Monday when Patrick Madden was cross-examined by Craig Wright's team. And it was interesting because a lot of the BSV and Craig Wright supporters, they really, really classed Monday as a massive victory. CoinGeek went as far as saying that Cooper forgery experts dismantled on the stand. So Patrick Madden was cross-examined, I think, if I remember correctly, for this, in this particular instance, purely from his first report and also the joint reports he'd done concerning the LaTeX files. Now, the reason why Craig Wright's side was so excited by what happened on Monday is because of a number of huge holes they found, they claimed, that Craig Wright's barristers put into his case, basically. And among them were anomalous time stamping, because Patrick Madden admitted that edit times can be impacted by someone not closing a Microsoft Word session in Citrix before quitting that session, which can lead to edit times of months or years when it's reopened again. He admitted he didn't use the Grammarly Enterprise version, which Craig Wright had claimed was the reason why certain Grammarly timestamps or Grammarly tags were found. He admitted that Craig Wright's computer environments were complex, which I'm not quite sure how that's relevant, but that was quite a moment for them, apparently. And he admitted he wasn't a LaTeX expert. As well as that, CoinGeek called this what's coming up a killing blow. They said that the fact that Patrick Madden worked with Bird and Bird to produce his reports meant that Madden wasn't independent, that he had bias. Arthur, of all those things, I mean, if we can take the more technical side and we can take the report writing side separately, if you like, but overall, how big were these bombshells that Craig Wright's team said that they blew up?
Yeah, I have two things indeed. Like you said, you make a separation about the more social factors around the report and the more technical aspects of the reports. We have reached six reports now. The sixth one was delivered last week, and up till that moment, when Madden was cross-examined, we had five reports up till then. So we are, basically it's about all those things. Now, first, the social aspects was mostly around Writing the report, he admitted that he took his, and it must have been quite a pile, and well, several piles of notes, and he did not find the time for either hiring his own assistant or, so he used assistancy from Bird and Bird. They worked out his report, as I understood it. That means that 100% of the text, well, maybe let's say 99% of the text is Madden. And of course, 100% of the findings is all Madden. But because somebody else has been shuffling around with the text, making the bullet points, make up the graphs in a neat order, and et cetera, et cetera. Yeah, so he that reeks, smells, but only a little, if you ask me, that he is probably, he might not have been independent enough, at least for the one who is trying to make something out of this almost nothing burger. To me, it might reek or smell like it, but he declared several times, no, all the text is mine, every finding is mine, all the 1500 plus pages that that I produced, it's all mine. But ordering the text and making a report with a staple through it, that was in the end the work of Bird and Bird. Yeah, they thought it was a big blow. Of course, it isn't. I cannot imagine that Justice Miller will have any issues with it. But we have, we have to see. He will probably, he will likely mention it in his ruling. But so far, no motions, no disqualifiers of any team came up. And in between, that was of course before last Monday, but before that, Craig Wright got the warning. You better stop discrediting the experts here, Mr. Wright, because I'm going to likely depend on them. So, yeah.
Well, the way I imagine it went is that he produced a report in bullet point form, because he had so much to get through that he would have done it in bullet point form and handed it over to them to write up. And they have either worked on it themselves and sent it to him, or, as seems to potentially be the case, they've come together to write up the report. But Cooper, or Bird and Bird, I should say, would have said, is it fair to say this? And he would have said yes or no. So I don't think there's anything more to it than that.
That is probably it. That if there has been text changes, then on the technical side, I cannot imagine that Bird and Bird had anything to say about the technical side of things, because that is the expertise of Mr. Madden himself. But of course, they will pour it in a legally acceptable in a way constructed with text that the judge can understand it, that the other parties in the lawsuit can understand what's going on. And like I say, the 99%, well, make it 95, I have no idea, of course. It will all be Madden's text and findings, except for that... the final touches have been done, the reshuffling of text has been done by Bird and Bird. Yeah, I would say a big deal. I mean, it doesn't change the findings, you know.
No, it doesn't. And the thing is as well, he knows he's going to be cross-examined. So he's not going to agree to something he doesn't believe in. Bear in mind, he's going to have to defend it on the witness stand. He doesn't know what he's going to be asked. So this whole thing about... I mean, I don't entirely get the argument. Is the argument that Bird and Bird wrote the report and made up the findings? Because he's the one that's going to have to explain it in the witness box. So I don't quite get what their argument is there. But no, I think, like you, I think this kind of thing... happens all the time. Like, I don't know, but I don't think this is any kind of massive bombshell. And I tell you what, when we come to the issue of bias later on, this is nothing. This is small fry compared to that. So, so moving on from that more social aspect, what did you make of the sort of four or five more technical points that Craig Wright's teammates. Do you think any landed particularly strongly and poked any particularly big holes in Madden's reports?
No, one little thing about that rewriting or help with writing. You can also see on all the witness statements, you can see that they have a template for witness statements and that contains text that is legally acceptable for the judge. For example, it is the truth and I did not see this, or I did not use that, or I did this to refresh my memory. Now, that is all legal text that they write down on behalf of the fact witnesses in the case. And they afterwards, they read that and they sign it off on behalf of themselves. Now, like I said, those type of things happen all the time, and I cannot imagine that the judge will have any problems with Madden getting a little bit of help on that side. Now, okay, more the technical things. Yeah, you know, I can understand that in general, Mr. Madden, with his, what was it, 20, 25 years of expertise, and they also complained that he only had 12 weeks of forensic expert training or something. No, yeah, I think that is quite nice, if you ask me. I can imagine that he also did several courses over the years to keep up with modern techniques, so it will not only be the 12... What was it? 12 weeks of training. But yeah. Nee, but for another example, when he admits that he is not an expert, for example, in LaTeX, yeah, so what? Then you hire, which they did, several other people who are experts in LaTeX or LaTeX components or whatever, and they ask them to write technical or fact witness statements also. I mean, that was all covered. That is not the bombshell that they think it is. Come on.
Yeah. So was there anything you think, because they mentioned about the time stamping and they mentioned about the Grammarly stuff and there's a few other technical points. Do you think that anything that Craig Wright's barristers brought up, do you think any of them will undermine his reports? Because obviously the aim was, you can't undermine every single investigation he did into every small piece because that's just impossible. So what you have to do is do your best to undermine everything. You undermine the witness rather than undermining what they said. So do you think there's anything in what they brought up that undermines Patrick Madden himself or his report to an extent that it could be damaging?
No, I don't. I seriously don't believe it. I would, by the way, do it the other way around. If it was my strategy in court, I would try to undermine let's say out of the, what was it, over 500 debunks that he did all over all the reports, I would try to pick five high profile findings of him and try to debunk it, and not just debunk it, but debunk it with all the evidence available that it is more than 100% sure that his findings were not accurate. Now, when such a thing, because then you get a situation that your judge is saying, wow, we have here an expert, but his five of his most high-profile findings are being debunked with quite serious stuff, that I have to reject the findings of this expert, of this forensic expert. That is quite serious. Mm-hmm. And then you get the situation that all his other findings will automatically also be taken less seriously. If you do a personal attack on the person, that will never have the full effect that, yeah, he might have not all the experience, he might not have all the papers, he might not have the right template to put it in, that it is appropriate for an UK forensic report, whatever they can find about stuff on the edges of the case, it will not fully debunk the content of the finding. So I would focus on the content of the finding and try to debunk it. Now, and if you think about it, what happened there? Nothing has been debunked with any finding they tried to create. And I had several online discussions with in majority with BSV fans, that they claimed to me that Yeah, Madden is he's dead. He's killed. His report will be wiped. They mop the floor with his report or whatever they things like that they said. But if you look at it with a sort of umbrella view, you will notice if his report contains all the evidence, like computer names, logon IDs, IP addresses, and it can all be traced back to Craig Wright, Craig Wright, Craig Wright, Craig Wright, and then they always come to the conclusion it was Mr. Wright who produced this forgery, or was aware of this forgery, or must have done something with this forgery, and etc., etc., etc. They never had anything to bring against that. Only, for example, is it possible that a Trojan file has been planted on his computer, so somebody else could have taken over his computer? And then, of course, Mr. Madden has to say, yeah, that is possible. Now, and I call that all the time, that is the 99.9% that is realistic. That is where Occam's razor comes in. It is the only person having the skill set, the motives, the motivation, the incentives, etc., to create all these forgeries, all the fingerprints and all the fingers, all the fingerprints of Wright are there, and all the fingers will always point at Craig Wright for creating that that forgery. And then that 0.01%, it might have been possible that something else had been has been happening. Yeah, that is possible, but that is not the what Occam Razor will tell you.
This whole thing of it's possible, I don't know how many times we heard that, and it was pretty clear early on that that was going to be their chief way of undermining his report, is by saying, yes, but it's possible he could have done this. Mm. It's possible he could have done that. And I think that through the court cases that I've seen live or you know, recordings of, that is pretty much the way they always go with it, because that's all they can really do. There's nothing to directly debunk the evidence itself. It's all trying to throw up the vaguest potential theories. But again, like you say, the judge will go back to what's more likely, and you have to look at not just that particular piece of evidence, but he will also be factoring in, I think, like you just said, everything else he's come across. So if there are 99 other things that he's pretty damn sure Craig Wright did, and there's one that is pretty clear it probably was, but there's a possibility it wasn't, he's likely to go with the fact it was Craig Wright, because the weight of all the other evidence is on his side, well, against Craig Wright, as far as that goes, I should say.
Yeah.
So, and something else that's related to that is that the cross-examination, it touched on a fraction of the evidence haul. And I know we weren't going into all the hundreds of forgeries, because the focus was on the 20 eventually. It was initially 50, but it was just 20 for the case. But it ignored so many that have therefore been accepted by the other side. So there are, you know, the pieces of evidence that weren't challenged, that means that that Cooper has got no argument, that Craig Wright's team has got no argument against them, and the judge will take them on as fact.
Yeah.
And like you mentioned previously, there are joint reports. It's not just Patrick Madden's report. His first report with the hundreds of forgeries was his. But since then, there's been three joint reports. And Craig Wright's own forensic examiners, who agreed with Patrick Madden, weren't cross-examined. Their findings have been accepted. And this completely ignored the fact that a lot of what Madden said has been agreed by Craig Wright's own forensic teams.
I was all the time when you were talking eager to mix in what I wanted to say. It would have been the only bombshell that was possible here is not only that indeed his findings I mentioned five, but for several high profile forgeries for the between the Reliance documents that Craig filed, if they found that they were genuine and they could prove that they were genuine, that would be a bombshell. And another bombshell would have been that the three forensic experts that have taken the side of COPA, which were indeed the forensic experts from Craig's side, they basically 80-90% They confirmed the findings of Madden, plus, of course, other forensic experts who were already on the COPPA site. I think in total, roughly six people. And if you take other LaTeX experts and the C++ inventor, you know, all those people made did findings and did statements against Craig Wright's lies and stuff that he said. It would have been a bombshell if those people, well, let's say the three people that that sided with Craig in the first place, or were supposed to side with Craig as a forensic expert, if they would withdraw their statements about siding with Madden. Well, that would have been a bombshell. All that did not happen.
Yeah. So that, I think, is something, because we didn't hear that in cross-examination. All you hear in cross-examination, all that comes across live on the day, are the issues that one side has with another side. It doesn't cover anything of what's already been accepted. And if we had a list of what's been accepted versus what's been challenged, I think it might have brought home to a lot of people who thought this was devastating for COPPA. It might have brought home that actually it wasn't at all.
you also know that a huge number. Yeah, we did a bonus episode about it, but the forensic experts of Wright themselves and other forensic experts, their statements, they were not cross-examined by Wright's side. They even, I think that was on Monday. Yeah, that was on Monday, late Monday. They also dropped, I think, two or three other forensic experts from the list, last minute, that they did not want to either file a report, I remember, or question, cross-examine two other forensic experts. They were supposed to do that, but they dropped it.
Yeah.
Now, yeah, that means that they accepted their findings. Did you also notice that Madden was supposed to go for 2 days on the stand, and it took less than a day? That is also something that I think, it's telling that they did not could not cross-examine him until he, they could mop the floor with him. They were done with him way faster than they expected.
Yeah, that is interesting. Actually, I didn't realize that. So Monday, so his cross-examination ended with this email bombshell that we'll come to later, but the impact of that was to bring him back for the last piece of witness testimony in the entire case on Friday. But before we get to that, on Tuesday we had Arthur Rosendahl, who was another forensics expert, who together with Spencer Lynch, who was one of Wright's forensic experts, who, as you say, Arthur was kicked from the case, shall we say, did not come to the stand. The pair of them wrote a joint report on the LaTeX files, in which they agreed that the original Bitcoin white paper was created in OpenOffice 2.4, as we know, and not in LaTeX. And they also both agreed that it wasn't too hard to take a PDF of the white paper, convert it into a LaTeX file using, I think, that ASPOS tool we mentioned in a previous episode, which one could then recompile into a PDF and almost airbrush the first conversion that took it from a PDF into the LaTeX file. They said it wasn't too hard to do that. Now, he was a lot firmer in his convictions. Not that Patrick Madden wasn't firm, but I think he was a bit nervous on the stand. But Arthur Rosendahl was really very natty bow tie he was wearing. He was quite a cool customer on the stand, actually. And generally, he held it pretty well. There was only one real, it wasn't even a bombshell, one real hole that Craig Wright's team tried to poke in his testimony. And that's when Craig Wright said that he'd use a combination of Windows and Linux when using LaTeX. And Arthur Rosendahl said it wasn't clear from Craig Wright's witness statements whether he had used the MikTeX distribution for Windows or the TeXLive distribution for Linux. And so he only performed his analysis using TeXLive. And which one did Craig Wright then say he had used? MikTeX, of course. So that was, yeah. I mean, did anybody expect anything otherwise?
you picked it up nicely. I missed that one.
Yes. Yeah.
Great catch.
So overall, what did you make, Arthur, of Arthur Rosendahl on the stand? He was, like I say, I thought he was quite cool, and he hit back a couple of times, didn't he, when he was pretty sure he was in the right.
Yeah, just a solid performance, like I found also from the previous week, Adam Beck and Martin Malmi, for example. There are a few people who stand out for me on the stand that I think, yeah, there's nothing wrong with you guys. You're just solid performers on the stand, honest and yeah, no issues.
And the other thing that I noticed as well, if you remember back to what Craig Wright said when he was discussing these forensic experts and basically saying that they weren't fit to do the job, he accused Arthur Rosendahl of being in bed with Bitcoin Core developers, of going to Bitcoin conferences, and he even claimed that that Arthur Rosendahl's savings would be lost if Craig Wright won the case, which is like, I mean, if that's true, that's obviously staggering, but you're like, well, where did he come up with this? And Arthur Rosendahl dismissed all these claims on the stand, and there was quite a funny moment. I don't know if you caught this, but when Mr. Hoff said, would your savings be ruined if Craig Wright won this case? And he said, I'd like to have some savings that could be ruined. So that was a nice moment.
Yeah, I remember it. I think he did not hold any Bitcoins, wasn't it?
No, nothing. He had no connection to Bitcoin whatsoever. And what was more interesting, I mean, you know, of course he would say that, and it's kind of one person's word against another, both under oath. But what was interesting is that Craig Wright's barrister said they would not be repeating those allegations in closing, and just totally washed their hands of what Craig Wright had said. So I think that tells you all you need to know, firstly, about Arthur Rosendahl's personality and Craig Wright's personality.
Yeah, and his own team, sort of throwing Craig Wright under the bus, because they will not repeat the allegations that they made, and they realized that Rosendahl was honest about it.
Yeah, so very interesting little diversion. The last thing to say on him is that it wasn't just the LaTeX files he examined. He also looked at other contents of the BDO and Samsung drives in a second joint report with another. It may have been Spencer Lynch as well, maybe part of the same report. So either way, he did either one or two joint reports. And again, both of the forensic experts for Craig Wright and for Cooper both agreed with all these findings from the BDO and the Samsung drives, as well as the LaTeX files. And if we remember, the findings from the BDO and the Samsung drives were that 71 of the 97 documents were manipulated, with the remainder 23 being, I forget what the actual phrase was, but not genuine, but sort of they showed signs of tampering, but they couldn't be properly examined or something along those lines. But
yeah, that, and then, you know, then they call them not credible or something,
yeah.
I think.
Yeah. So overall, there were a little bit, I mean, the thing, like I said in the previous episode, Monday and Tuesday with the analysis of the forensic experts was where the case could potentially be won and lost. And I know that Craig Wright's team think they have destroyed the forensic reports, but again, I have to go back to this point that all that was tackled was a tiny subset of the whole thing. And the judge is going to be reading all the reports. He's going to be reading the reports of the BDO drives, the Samsung drives, the LaTeX files, and everything else that came before that. And if the best that Craig Wright's camp has got is the holes that they poked during those 2 days, it's just not even scratching the surface, is it?
No. And especially what they thought, that the harm that they thought that they had done to Patrick Madden, I think, is pretty exaggerated, so to say.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. So that covered Monday and Tuesday in the forensic expert. Wednesday, we saw the cryptocurrency experts. As you say, we had Zeming Gao. I'll come to him in a second. But for COPA, we had Sarah Micklejohn, who is a professor in cryptography and security at University College in London and a staff research scientist at Google. And Craig Wright's expert, Zeming Gao, a quote, true polymath with a remarkable journey, unquote, which is quite a difference. I'm doing him a little bit of a disservice. He's actually a company as a product strategist for his own company, Capable Consulting, and he's an IP lawyer. But nowhere in there is there any any education in cryptography or anything like that. And it really made me laugh comparing those two, that Craig Wright said that Professor Micklejohn is the one that didn't have that wasn't up to snuff when it came to cryptocurrency affairs. I thought that was a staggering assertion to make, given the qualifications that she's got.
Yeah, and Mr. Gao is only for a few years. I remember when he entered the BSV arena as an, as a fan of Craig Wright. I think on LinkedIn he posted, and I think he moved away from LinkedIn. Maybe he's still on LinkedIn. I don't know. I'm not on LinkedIn, so. But he is now a bit more on Twitter, and he is writing his own articles. He wrote a book last year about Bitcoin. But but he's not a Bitcoin OG, as far as I understand. I think he's only into Bitcoin or BSV for 3, 4, 5 years, maybe at the most. So I would not consider him an expert, actually. I did not even expect him, because I thought that he did not have to show up anymore. But he showed up anyway, because there was a little part that he had to explain or that they could ask him about. But the, and I don't know how big that report is, because I did not see it yet. But he explained a bit later on Twitter that it was a rather substantial part of the report that he wrote, his expert report. That part was about Bitcoin history and Bitcoin functionality, and comparing with the white paper. That is what I imagine about it. But we knew already from a ruling, even before the trial started, that Mellor said, "Yeah, but it has nothing to do what your opinions are on Bitcoin. It's about the identity of Mr. Wright being Satoshi or not, and what project he's running is irrelevant. So I don't want to hear on cross examinations anything about that part of the report." So and that's how it happened, that we did not hear about what is the true Bitcoin. Is that a Bitcoin, or is that BSV?
Now, we won't go into too much detail about what was discussed over the signing sessions, because it got quite technical. It didn't particularly lead us anywhere. There was a lot of Professor Micklejohn looking confused when she was questioned by Mr. Orr for Craig Wright, and answering things as best as she could, given his convoluted and sometimes odd questioning. But what was interesting was that Ziming Gao was pretty much led down a road by Mr. Hoff, as we have seen him do in this trial so far, to essentially undermine Craig Wright's claims over the signing sessions and what took place, and saying that, yeah, he could pretty much easily have faked them. That was what I saw. Is that what you saw as well?
Exactly. That is exactly what happened. There was nothing that he disagreed substantially with Micklejohn. And like you say, the cross-examination went indeed like that, that he admitted that a lot of things could have gone wrong. And not wrong, but could have been faked or been a fraud in the signing sessions.
So after that discussion, Mr. Hoff brought up this idea of a lack of independence, which of course we know from the Madden situation, and Craig Wright's very keen on independent experts. And for those that have had any exposure to Ziming Gao, they'll know he is a huge proponent of Craig Wright being Satoshi Nakamoto. So given that that's already very public information, it's a surprise that Craig Wright put him up as an independent expert. But maybe that was the only person left in the thoroughly scraped barrel that there was left to go for. So it was clear from his own writing and from what Mr. Hoff brought up that he believes Craig Wright is Satoshi, and that it matters to him. He really cares deeply about the fact that Craig Wright is Satoshi Nakamoto. And he tried to explain this by saying he followed Bayesian philosophy, which meant he had looked at all the facts. It wasn't an opinion based on a gut reaction or gut feeling. It was based on the facts. And so he wasn't impartial because he'd looked at the facts. But the BSV fans were, they treated him with awe and reverence. Like, there are some comments that he was truly awesome. He was a class act. And someone else said afterwards, "Well said, Sir Zem, you're exactly right. Just because you've reached a conclusion doesn't make you not objective. You used a very high degree of logic and discernment to reach your conclusions. That's what any intelligent being does. Thank you for your service to the truth. Now, I don't think these people realise that it doesn't matter how he came to his conclusion. He is still very, very partial. You can't go writing the kind of things he's written and claim to be impartial or independent. The easiest way to test his impartiality is to put him up against the COPA independent crypto expert, Professor Micklejohn. So if Zimin Gao is impartial, then what is she? Because she has never espoused a view one way or the other about Craig Wright being Satoshi. She probably doesn't care. She was sourced because she knows a lot about cryptocurrency. She was sourced and asked her opinion on Bitcoin and BSV and the signing sessions. She had probably never heard of Craig Wright before. That is an impartial person. Someone that has never given their view. And like, I just don't understand this idea that they think you can be impartial when you've already made your mind up. That's the exact opposite of what impartial means.
Yeah, exactly.
And another good test is, what would they be saying? Like, let's say that through Patrick Madden's testimony, someone dug up an old blog post he'd written saying Craig Wright's a fraud, or even less than that. Let's say he'd liked one of your Medium articles or liked one of your anti-Craig Wright tweets. Would they be saying, oh, it's okay, because he's probably come through it through a logical conclusion? No, they'd be saying, look, he's anti-Craig Wright. He's not impartial, wouldn't they?
Yeah. No, yeah, anything. But like you said, that is the best comparison that you can make. If somebody has never said anything about Craig Wright, who is not even a specialist in Bitcoin itself, for example, which is, I think, was the case with Micklejohn. She hardly did anything with cryptocurrencies, if I remember well. Yeah, then you can just be a cryptographer and judge the blog post that Craig Wright put online on the 2nd of May in 2016 and judge it on its merits as a completely independent expert on cryptography, and ask the opinion of what does this blog post tell you? Now, and if such a person then says, yeah, this is gobbledygook, this is not even close to proving something that would be pointing to a Satoshi Nakamoto identity of the writer of this stuff. Now, yeah, then you have an independent expert saying that.
So, looking at the cryptocurrency experts, they didn't add a whole lot to the entire argument. And I may have glossed over what they actually said regarding the signing sessions, but I don't think it really had any massive impact. But again, if we talk about Patrick Madden and the desire for Craig Wright's side to undermine his abilities and his capabilities when it comes to looking at the thing as a whole, with regards to attempting to undermine him, to undermine his entire report because he, as a person, is not qualified. If you take that approach, you had one objective, impartial cryptocurrency expert and another who wasn't impartial and wasn't a cryptocurrency expert, and two-thirds of whose witness testimony was already struck from the record. So if you look at that on its face, there was only one like winner there, wasn't there?
Yeah, if you do such a day by day, who wins today? Then this was a day for COPA.
Definitely. So moving on to Friday and the email, which is what everyone was waiting for, which everyone's waiting for us to talk about. So we'll start with a little bit of a preamble as to what led up to this point, and then we'll discuss what Craig Wright said on the stand, and we'll go through his excuse and his rationale for that. So, going back to Craig Wright's initial time on the witness stand, he claimed that Ontier and Alex Partners had both received access to his MYOB accounting software in late 2019 as part of the Clyman case, where they ran reports and extracted data. Now, in this case, because of an email that was found in the Tulip Trading case that was passed over to the law firms in this case, they found that actually Ontier said they didn't receive access to the MYOB database, the MYOB account, until March 9th, 2020. And this is important because someone used Craig Wright's login on March the 6th or 7th, 2020, just 2 or 3 days before Ontier got access, to add transactions regarding Bitcoin transfers into Wright International Investments dated to 2010. Just days before Ontier got it. Now, that was the argument to this point. So we had an immediate discrepancy there, and Patrick Madden looked into these emails and found some flaws with them. So Craig Wright, seemingly wanting to prove that he was right in his assertion that they did get access in 2019, he had said on the stand he had emails to prove it. And on February the 18th this year, Ramona Watts forwarded an email chain to Shoesmiths, which on its face contained evidence that Ontier did indeed get access in December 2019. So Ontier went looking for the email in their servers, found it, and sent it to Shoesmiths, drawing their attention to the fact that the top email in the chain was entirely different from the version that Ramona Watts had sent. So this meant only one thing. One of those emails was a fake. So Arthur, we came to Friday with this genuine bombshell this time, wondering what Craig Wright was going to say to try and explain this discrepancy. He went into lots of technical detail, which we'll dive into. But overall, what was his overall story regarding how this happened? Who did he throw under the bus?
Now, first of all, when it was announced on Monday, I already noticed that Lord Grabener, I think he's called, the guy who brought this news. I think it was not Orr who did it. I think it was Grabener, yeah. Who announced it.
No, it was Lord Grabener.
You could already notice that he was very embarrassed by this event, because what happened when those emails were exchanged between Shoesmith and Ontier, because Shoesmith is, I think they are quite clever. Quite clever. How can you be quite clever? It's just normal due diligence when you have a serial forger as a client, and you check everything that he is bringing in. And so they check with Ontier, and Ontier said that this smells like somebody has been forging and doing things with that email thread, because we did not have access to MIOP before March 2020. And when then they found an email on their email server, which was indeed dated December 2019. Now, for them, it was like, Shoesmith, you have to do something here, because we are not very content with what is going on here. We are being the victim of forgery, or at least an inconsistent story where we have nothing to do with, and we don't want to have anything to do with it either. So we demand that you bring this up in court and ask the judge for advice or something like that. Now, so it ended up that that's why Craig's side came with this story, because normally you would expect that evidence comes in at Shoesmith, and Shoesmith, with a normal customer, they don't even have to check things, and they will hand over that evidence to the other side, to the other party in the lawsuit. But that that didn't happen here yet, because COPPA had not seen that stuff yet. So the only thing they said on Monday was, we cannot comment at this moment, but we will have, of course, our forensic expert, Mr. Madden, on it. You can expect his report around Wednesday, and we can already start planning a cross-examination of people on Friday. No, and that's indeed how it happened. On Wednesday, the report came in. We did not see it yet, so we don't know the content, but we know a little bit the content, because they discussed it, of course, on Friday. And they started with Craig Wright, and if I have to give my own summary, I found on Reddit a slightly longer summary. I will read it, because it gives a good insight on how people perceived this story. It appears a bit convoluted, because there are several emails. Craig talks about spoofing, other people talk about forging, or it is a combination of forging and spoofing, etc., etc. But for me, it was quite clear there has been an email forgery, a rewritten email. That rewritten email went to Ontier. Ontier passed that rewritten or forged and backdated, of course, because it never happened in December in that sense with that content. So Shoesmith had an an forged email. So there has been a, it has been a case of forgery, and Craig tried to rewrite that event into, yeah. And this for me is the damning detail in this story. He claims that a hacker has been spoofing with emails from his on his side, and that happened exactly 33 minutes before his wife sent the email. Before he sent the email to his wife, and his wife then forwarded that stuff to Shoesmith. And there was only 33 minutes between them. Now, for me, that is the detail that that brings this whole story together.
Hmm.
How is it even possible that an external hacker is following Craig Wright in his house when he is working on his server, when he is picking up evidence that he needs for a case that he is running? And several days earlier, there was a question about it. And then to discredit him, that is Craig's claim at least, to discredit him, the email was picked up, changed, sent to Ontier to discredit him. And then 33 minutes later, that same email went to his wife, and from his wife to Shoesmith. Something like that. Now, yeah, that is of course an inconceivable story from here to Tokyo. And I'm quite sure already that Judge Meller will not judge otherwise about this. But let's go. If you you have something to say in between, but otherwise I will read what the guy on Reddit said. It was also quite nice.
Well, yeah, talking about the whole half an hour thing, I think, like you say, that's quite an important point, because it's just totally implausible in itself. But I was going to say, it reminds me of his previous claims regarding some of the forgeries the ATO discovered in that very fruitful 2014 investigation era, when he said that someone had hacked into his machines and dropped fake documents, manipulated documents, on his systems just in time for him to send them to the ATO as evidence.
Yeah.
Like it's the same thing happening all over again. It's someone doing something just in time to undermine him. And again, not just that, it's someone doing something just in time, which on its surface seems to support his claim, knowing that it's going to be examined and then found to be the opposite. It's such a convoluted way of doing things. If you're a hacker trying to bring somebody down, you wouldn't even pretend to send something that initially backs their story. It's utterly, utterly laughable. And the same thing is happening 10 years later.
Yeah. No, exactly. Exactly.
Did you see on Reddit, there was a user by the name of Satoshi Taste who put a great little summary of the email situation together? Did you see that?
Yeah. Satoshi Taste. I don't know him, to be honest. I know several people on Reddit because I do browse around and post every now and then on Reddit, mostly on Twitter. But this person, Satoshi Taste, I didn't know. But he actually had an just briefly, so I will quickly run you through what he said. Hey, so I was trying to understand what Craig is claiming during his cross-examination on the email issue. But I was really unable to follow. BitMEX Research made a couple of infographics. It's true. I put one of those infographics, by the way, in my most recent article. Yesterday I brought out an article about this case, so that's why I dived into it for a bit more. A doom loop of lying. Again, a big hit on the internet. It's going viral already, because I work out that whole case from Monday to Friday, and I have the transcripts of two different people who have been watching what happened on Friday.
Mm-hmm.
Now, anyway, Satoshi Taste. So to sum up, Craig claims that he replied twice in 2019 to the 1344 email from Ontiers. Thanks, Craig. What is this about? So there is a supposedly genuine 2019 email going coming back from Ontiers to Craig.
Mm-hmm.
And one email with a MIOP login at 1451 and then with old info about IP and BlackNet at 56. Ontiers got the second email, but the first was perhaps caught on their spam filters. That is what Craig is claiming. Yeah. That's all Craig's claim. And so that's why how you have to try and make sense of this story. He forwards the entire chain to his wife on the 18th of February 2024, which is only, what is it, 2 weeks ago, which in turn forwards it to Shoesmith as evidence to support Craig's claim, which he made a few days earlier in court, that Ontiers had the MIOP logins as early as 2019 and not March 2020, as they claim. However, some evil adversary, 33 minutes before Craig forwarded the email chain to his wife, created a spoofed version of the 2019 MIOP login email with the exact same content and sent it to Ontiers to appear as if Craig had sent it. In other words, this adversary played 4D chess by knowing that the 2019 email about the MIOP login was never received by Ontiers, knowing that Craig's site was about to use this email exchange as evidence, and spoofed the lost email as if sent by Craig just before he forwarded the real email to his wife, making it appear as if Craig is a forger. Oh, yeah, God. This is real 4D chess.
I really struggle to get my head around the whole around his argument here, because it just runs out of road so quickly. Why did the okay? Let's assume that his story is real. Why did the hacker send the email to Ontier in the first place? I don't understand why they would send it to Ontier.
Now, yeah, that is either, and that is also what I think by myself. It went to a guy called Simon Cohen, and Simon Cohen is not a person working at Ontier anymore. So to give most of the credibility to an email is actually send it. But if you send it to a receiver who is not working there anymore, he cannot, that person, the receiver cannot complain or otherwise do something with that email. That might have been a guess that Craig Wright has been making, or the forgerer that Craig Wright is pointing his fingers to, that this email would go unnoticed and remain unnoticed until the length of time on the server of Ontiers. But of course, Shoesmith, being the sort of clever guys that they are currently now are, knowing their client, they went after the forwarded emails of his wife and asked confirmation at Ontiers what happened here. And they found that must have been an unread, backdated to December the 2nd, 2019 email that was received on the on the server of the email server of Ontiers, addressed to this Simon Cohen, who is not working there anymore.
I love the fact that Craig Wright's relationship with Ontier, which broke down obviously pretty badly, and who he has blamed for so many of his legal failings in the court cases since they left, that relationship was so bad that they probably could not wait to get an opportunity to screw him over. So the way that he has behaved all these years to his various law firms comes back to bite him, because if they'd had a really good relationship, I'm not saying that they would have brushed it under the carpet, but they wouldn't have been so effusive with Shoesmith. They basically said, you make sure you bring this up in court, because if you don't, we will. And if the relationship between themselves and Craig Wright hadn't broken down to such an extent, they may not have been that strong. So again, it's his behavior, the way he treats people, just comes back to bite him again, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. But this is happening all the time. But the peculiar and for me the most damning side of this is that it is now happening not only with people. This has now become a case of what is called fraud upon the court. It has been dated within the time frame of the running lawsuit. And on top of that, several counsels are now involved. His previous counsel is involved. His current counsel is now involved. And because the other party, COPA's counsel, is now having done the inquiry, the forensic inquiry on this stuff, they are now also involved. So he has now three counsels and a judge against him about forged emails. My God, this could potentially explode quite heavily.
So we'll come to Friday. Now, as you said, Patrick Madden had to do a report on this. We haven't seen that yet, but what we do know was what was brought up in court in a cross-examination of Craig Wright and also Patrick Madden's cross-examination himself as well. What were the two little bits of, or one or two little nuggets we got from that report? There was something about an Enchain logo, I believe.
Yeah, that was for me, to be honest, I because it's so convoluted and that is hard to remember by head, so I only picked up the headlines and the major points to hit, because, like I said, he's bringing up all kinds of things, all kinds of settings, and Google this and Outlook that, and I was like, yeah, but make your point. Mm. And what have you been using? What should have been used? What did Google exactly that you did not like? But I cannot get my real finger behind it. But one of the things that we can really say about it is that there was an logo on these, an image, a little image on these emails. The logo image for Enchain. And that image contained a property. The timestamp is only explained by this email being created in this form in December 2020. So that means that on the email of 2019, which is the forgery, it contained a logo with a timestamp of the 2020. Now, yeah, and that is, of course, technically not possible.
And Craig Wright's argument for that was that that was the time when the email was downloaded, not the time when the email was sent, which I don't know, you know, I don't know the correctness or otherwise of that, but that was his excuse anyway.
Yeah.
There was also some talk about some the RCJBR and tuliptrading.net domains and something about, is it DNS dates? Something had been updated like in the last few days, but again, that was too technical for me. Can you explain that one?
Yeah, that was also a little bit too technical for me. It mean that had to do with protection against spoofing. And he only put protection against spoofing a few days ago, I think. But a bit of a guess again, but it was rather recent, like the day before the cross-examination, mm-hmm. like on Thursday. So they figured out with public information, that is quite cool that type of information is available online, that he indeed changed settings, I think SPF settings or something.
That was it, yeah.
Which should be a protection against spoofing. Now, that is for me already again something that is unbelievable. We are talking about the most accredited IT cybersecurity expert on the globe, if we have to believe all his credentials. Mm-hmm. With he has been running projects in the millions all over the world with the customers everywhere. That are the claims, at least. And he doesn't even know how to protect himself against email spoofing. Sorry.
Well, I'll run through some other excuses he gave as well. So one of the first things he said was that the reason why the emails appeared so damning was because they were missing emails from earlier in the chain, which we can only presume completely exonerate him. They just happened to be missing from the chain. He also blamed server migration from one to another, which again is something we saw in 2014 when he blamed the time stamping of certain documents. He's certain documents with creation dates of 2014. He said they were created in 2011, but when he was hacked, or when he had to check, when his companies were closed down, he had to rebuild servers. And when he rebuilt the servers, it changed the creation dates of the documents to 2014. So again, we've got, he's claiming that server migration is changing dates of things. He claimed that it couldn't have been him because he didn't use Outlook, which we can't really prove, but he's used Word for years. He's used Excel for years. I very much doubt he uses all the Microsoft suite of packages, suite of products, but doesn't use Outlook. He prefers Google's web browser. I don't believe that for a second. Didn't he also change his mind over which email was faked? I remember Mr. Hoff saying, you were saying that this email was the real one. Now you're saying this is the real one. Again, I lost my way a bit on that one, but was he unclear about which one was faked?
Nay, same here, Mark. That's why I was happy that BitMEX Research, a good guy working there, they posted two or three of those images, infographs, I call them, with the flows of several emails. Now, it's a bit of a convoluted piece of work because we are talking about existing threads where he took one email, he took out, put it back as a forgery or not, or as a spoofed email, and it went both to Ontier, another part went to his wife, then it went to Shoesmith, his counsel. So it's a bit of a convoluted flow of emails going back and forth, with where three or four people or parties have several opinions, where Ontier has an opinion, where Shoesmith has an opinion, where Copa has an opinion, where Craig Wright has an opinion, what exactly happened there. So to be fair, it only happened 2 days ago. I'm still a bit lost in that what exactly happened. But for me, it is 100% clear that there is an email forgery at place, and that has been sent with a backdated. He had to use a computer or a laptop with a clock setting. The system clock setting was put backward to 2019 to in an effort to try give that email all the dates that it should have at arrival at the person who should receive it, which was Simon Cohen, as said. Now, there was also several things to say about that dating, that Google does something with that dating and Outlook does something with that dating. And yeah, again, so I am a bit lost, but there has been forging going on, explained by Craig Wright as spoofing by an external party. And that is the part that I don't believe, and the part that I do believe is the forging. And as far as I'm concerned, the judge will also take that that position, because that is the position of Patrick Madden also. There has been forging going on, and that is considered perverting the course of justice.
The moment that we saw this on Monday, those of us that have been following Craig Wright for a while were like, well, that's classic. That's absolute classic Craig Wright, a sloppy backdating forgery that's been caught. It's so, you know, it ticks all the boxes. And it goes further than that, because it yet again requires you to believe in an extraordinary set of circumstances all happening together within half an hour of the original email being sent, to believe that it wasn't him that did it, when the most obvious answer, when you look, if you took it as a single crime, you're talking again means, motive and opportunity, it's him. It's like he's the most obvious candidate for all three. And again, his excuses, his reasons were so, again, that was classic as well, technobabble. Just blind them with technobabble and try and dig your way out of it that way. But once you strip all that away, it really is just another of the classic Craig Wright forgeries that we've come to know and love over the years.
Yeah.
So talking of third parties, when it came to who had done this, This is one thing as well that Craig Wright's been very clear on. He is very quick to mention there could be hundreds and hundreds of people had access to my emails. It could be anyone, it could be this person, it could be that person. But when it comes to actually naming somebody, he more often than not shies away from naming someone, except on this occasion, he did name someone, as we alluded to. So, Arthur, tell us then, what crimes did Craig Wright accuse you of on the stand?
And he did not mention me once, he mentioned me twice. Amazing, amazing. Yeah, that was, again, of course I have a big smile when such a thing happened. I have to be honest, it's sort of an, in a weird way,
it's an honor
to be to be mentioned by the guy that you're constantly debunking as a fraud, and now he is somehow he finds a way to mention me and try to get me back or something. But in fact, he mentioned something twice. It were not more than hints. It was an answer to the question that indeed, who do you expect has been hacking you and has been spoofing or forging with your email at a distance? That he immediately came up with my name, but what he mentioned is that he noticed that I had screenshots, that I had information that should have been only available to COPA, the party where he is fighting against in court, mm-hmm. and COPA should not have had or have allowed that stuff was on the streets or something. Or he implied that because I have, that is my side, my interpretation, of course, that I have been hacking COPA, have been screenshotting things from the COPA systems, which is of course illegal. Let me, there's nothing that's so clear as what. And I was spreading that or leaking that on the internet, and that is what he noticed. So because I have been hacking COPA, then it was also implied that I have been hacking him. So I did the forging and spoofing with his email on the 18th of November. February this month. Last month. We are already March. Mm-hmm. And not once, but twice. He even explained that in a few more details, one or two sentences extra when it passed by, when Judge Meller at the end of the session also ask him about if you think about those few hundred people, what comes to mind? And I did not do an inquiry, so I cannot be sure. But Arthur van Pelt has been spreading screenshots, and that is information that should not be out there. That's not public information. Something like that. So I was like, okay, he does not completely, his modus operandi is normally he takes an existing story, something with somebody in real life, that is something that has happened, an actual event, mm-hmm. a truthful event. What I think what happened is that he noticed after his court sessions and between writing patents and and doing other consultancy work, he has been browsing around on the internet, especially on Twitter. He looked at my tweets and he noticed that I have been tweeting in the last days or weeks information that he thought was not public. Now, what I can only imagine when he mentioned COPA, because he did, he connected my name to COPA information that I had been leaking and spreading that was supposed to stay private on their systems, then I can only make the connection to what happened now by head roughly 2 weeks ago. There was a Dropbox created where mm-hmm. COPA or people representing COPA, which is probably COPA's counsel then, have been literally dropping many filings, witness statements, expert reports, skeleton arguments, all kinds of stuff you can find in that public Dropbox. And that's where I indeed I take a lot of information, especially the expert reports. I find quite interesting. What I have been tweeting, just one example, because I found it quite interesting, that in 2014, Craig, in October 17 of 2014, Craig Wright registered a website, an internet domain, tuliptrading.net. And that was quite funny, because already in 2019, we are talking about like 5 years ago, I knew about that already and I acquired that already. Mm-hmm. And I noticed that October 2014 was a very productive month for him for creating a lot of forgeries and contracts and backdated stuff and doing things with emails. Around the Tulip Trust, and part of that was also the registration of tuliptrading.net. Mm-hmm. Now, in recent days, Patrick Madden, the forensic expert of COPA, has also been looking at that exact same registration date of tuliptrading.net, because he came across several forgeries, I think at least a handful, from the... I'm not sure if it was the Reliance documents or related to the Reliance documents, but at least it was worthwhile to put in his most recent expert report, which was only 2 weeks, roughly 2 weeks old. And so I could not help bragging a little bit about my own work of 2019. So I grabbed a 2019 tweet where I tweeted out that inquiry result. Mm-hmm. And I put that alongside the Patrick Madden finding in his report, that he found that because of tuliptrading.net, blah, 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 those five things are with ID numbers, etc., but those five documents we can consider being forgeries, backdated forgeries, because tuliptrading.net did not exist before October 2014. Mm-hmm. Such a tweet, and I did several of those type of tweets, came in front of came on the screen of Craig Wright, and he thought, wow, that guy has access to forensic expert reports that I probably not even have read myself every page. How is this possible?
The thing is, he's also thought that you would willingly, to get a bit of internet clout, you would willingly undermine COPA's own case by publicizing evidence they would presumably have told you not to. So he thinks that's happened as well.
What Craig has been saying, thinking, is that I have been hacking in the systems of COPA, just like Ager Hansen. I'm getting a connection almost with Ager Hansen, it looks like.
You are,
That Ager Hansen has been hacking his stuff, but also has been hacking Bert and Bert over a public Wi-Fi.
Right, so that's how you got it.
And stuff like that. He just makes up things on the spot. Yeah. To make it believable for his audience that I am the bad guy and he is not. So I must have been hacking the systems of COPA in some way and gained access to information that I should not have made public yet.
The thing is, in that case, we're both guilty, because our entire bonus episode last week about the unseen witnesses was all the information was taken directly from that Dropbox. So we're both guilty, because the entire episode is based on hacked material.
Exactly. But he probably doesn't know, because he's not an...
he's not a member.
He's not a member, so he doesn't know.
Oh, dear, that was quite a moment. That was quite a moment when you're...
This seriously, and don't forget, if you are being name-dropped in this sense by an person who is in a court case, a high-profile court case, this really has some side effects, because a lot of BSV people jumped on my neck and they wished me everything between No, there were no death threats. That was not the case this time. But many people see me already. Yeah, Craig is going to win, and then he's going to after you. You're going to be sued, and you did things. You're a criminal, this and that, and yeah, and that's how you are being treated immediately because the big boss of BSV is claiming things that has no footing in reality whatsoever. But and I tried to explain a few times, and I dropped the link to the Dropbox. Hey, it's even accessible to you. This is nothing secret going on here. So Craig is wrong. He probably doesn't know that COPA has been spreading, or at least people who are related to COPA, they have been spreading this public Dropbox. It is there's nothing secret going on here. This is just the court material, all the filings that are relevant for COPA, and they will, of course, not make things public. Yeah, that, I did not say that, of course, but that's what I can say now. They will not make things public without permission of the other party. So Craig's counsel must have given permission to because sometimes there are filings that contain private information, and then you have to blacken that out, for example. But I noticed that several pieces of information in there, they are blackened out. So, yeah, they do things properly at COPA, or people related to COPA.
So that was the end of Friday's session. Well, we had Patrick Madden taking the stand afterwards for a couple of questions, but there was no great revelations after that, and that concluded all the evidence. Now, bearing in mind that CoinGeek has, and BSV supporters have been all over Twitter and all over social media and what have you when things go Craig Wright's way, the fact that what happened or what didn't happen after his appearance on Friday suggests that they're not overly confident about his explanations, because CoinGeek completely ignored the events of the entire day and focused instead on an article called, and I'm not kidding here, Sights and Sounds of the Satoshi Trial, in which they covered a few of their favorite bits and pieces throughout the trial, their favorite moments, and never once mentioned these emails, either when they happened on Monday or the investigation or the cross-examination on Friday. So that just shows how much faith they've got in Craig Wright's excuses.
Yeah.
So that brought everything to a close on Friday. So we can sort of, I mean, we've got closing arguments. We've got a week off next week and then closing arguments the week after. But unless something extraordinary happens in the meantime, that is it for the COPA versus Craig Wright trial. So we can start to take some sort of looks back at the last, not just the last few weeks, but the last three years it's been now. So Arthur, do you think, given what your first thoughts were when this was filed and seeing how things have changed as the discovery process and the time leading up to the trial has happened, did the events of the trial itself live up to your expectations of what it would involve?
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. The shocking things is more on the upside than on the downside, and then I call the downside the bombshell information that might have been leading to an Satoshi ruling, but there were no watermark revelations, there were no secret signings, there were no credit card payments for Bitcoin.org suddenly popping up, and then all that all that evidence with a big wow factor, it never happened, which was to be expected, if I'm honest. But on the what I call the upside is that especially examples of Craig Wright trying to bring in more forgeries than I ever thought, compared to the Hodlnot case that was 71. Now, this lawsuit alone is over 500 forgeries. It is amazing. My three favorite moments of this trial, I wrote also three articles about it. The first one was about Craig Wright, he cannot code. Hey, that was the famous incident. Yeah, there were several of those incidents, but everybody will remember the incident about the unsigned integer.
Yes, yeah.
Oh my God.
That's gone down in folklore already.
Yeah. But that was my moment. My moment of the whole trial. If I have to take one moment that is where I would put for me the umbrella of the case is under that anecdote. It was only a few seconds, half a minute, where it happened that Craig Wright was silenced about something that he could not explain, that is used in Bitcoin over 500 times. It is amazing. It is amazing. Now, the second article was about what I found the most interesting witnesses of this whole lawsuit, which were Adam Beck and Marty Malmy. Now, that is where the Bitcoin OGs, the OGs of OGs, completely destroyed, I would like to say, Craig writes when he tries to mingle his story into the Bitcoin history, and you see those people with the true history of Bitcoin dripping from every body part that they have. Adam Beck was, as we know now, the first person to have contact with the real Satoshi. He only revealed five different emails, and they were already enough to debunk several pieces of information that Craig Wright had said about his history in Bitcoin around that same era. And we're talking about August 2008 up till January in 2009. That was the period where Adam Beck had contact with Satoshi. And we're talking about, of course, Marty Malmy. Now, yeah, that is an even bigger story almost, because they exchanged several hundreds of emails. A bunch is lost, we understood from Marty Malmy, but still some 260, 65, I think, are still have remained, and they have also been released. Yeah, quite interesting. And already just one anecdote that Craig Wright said, I was already in contact with Marty Malmy in February 2009. Now, Marty Malmy showed his first email with Satoshi, which was dated May 2009. That was 3 months later. So those type of discrepancies were quite obvious during the day that Adam Beck and Marty Malmy were on the stand. And there was also a special moment for me with Adam Beck when he was explaining technical things about Bitcoin, that he even knew more about Bitcoin than was ever written in the white paper. I think it was about difficulty adjustments, adjustment stuff, things, quite technical, floating things, how it was calculated. And for me, it was quite clear that Adam Beck knows it even better than Satoshi himself, almost. But Adam Beck explained that as, Satoshi, he did it in this order. And when he wrote the white paper, he probably summarized and simplified things a little bit just to have it summarized in the white paper. Now, quite interesting. And of course, the third thing that I found interesting is a clear-cut case of fraud upon the court, which was this email in the last week.
I think for me, if we're talking the major things that are going to remain after it's finished, I do think this final bombshell has been the big thing, because the rest of it was expected. We knew what was coming with a lot of it, and if maybe not if the details, but certainly the content of what was going to be explored. And so to have this just dropped by Craig Wright's own counsel at the beginning of that week, after he'd finished testifying, to then bring him back in to answer it, I thought it was just a perfect microcosm of how he operates. It was just an amazing moment that stunned everybody. So that was my takeaway. I think for me, the thing that if I think back to the beginning, like when the lawsuit was filed and how things have gone until the trial, I think it showed a big difference in the way that the Craig Wright supporters viewed the trial, and the way that I don't like to say Bitcoiners, because I don't necessarily think it's completely BSV versus Bitcoin, but let's say the the supporters of COPA will say, for the sake of argument, even though that's the same principle, the way that they both treated it. Because you had Craig Wright's team, Calvin Ayer, and everyone saying they were so looking forward to it because they could get all this evidence in front of the judge and it would be the one case that would confirm it. And then as we got closer and closer, and even when these reports, the Madden report came out, they were still so pro Craig. They were still so looking forward to what was coming. There was all, again, we started to get the talk of I think Gavin Mayall said that he's going to bring in the vice president of MasterCard to prove that he bought the Bitcoin.org domain in 2008. And, you know, and then when it started, there was all the talk of, oh, he's going to be talking about BSV on the stand. The world's going to know about BSV for the first time. And then they didn't understand that the witness statements had gone in and all that was going to be tackled was a bit of, they didn't understand for the start that Craig was going to be cross-examined, purely cross-examined for that first, those first few days. They were waiting for him to get his chance to be examined by his own counsel, not realizing that wasn't going to happen. Yeah. So, you know, and then you had, like you said, the stenography, the watermarks, is he going to sign? There's this, there's that. It was like this ever-rolling wheel of expectation. And it wasn't until, for me, it wasn't actually until Friday when he was on the stand for the last time and he finished and there was none of that. And I think that was the first time for a lot of them that it dawned on them what just happened. And I do wonder if a lot of them are looking back thinking, shit, is that it? I think there's a bit of a, I think, whereas a lot of the people that want Craig Wright to lose have, what they saw is what they expected, and it's actually been better than what they expected. And I think a lot of people for Craig Wright's team, apart from the ones that are paid shills and are complete fantasists, are surprised by what happened and are negatively surprised by what happened, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I think so. I think so. On the other hand, we noticed a little pump in the BSV price starting yesterday.
Oh, really?
So where that comes from is a bit of a mystery to me. Yeah, not a big one. I mean, it went from 70, 80 to $120 or something. I mean, nothing special, but for the BSV fans, it's quite something.
Has anyone yet mentioned that Justice Mellor's buying BSV because he's going to rule for Craig Wright? Has that come up yet? Because I can only assume that it has. I bet you it's somewhere.
No. It is are the BTC laser eyes who are now hedging because they realize that Craig is going to win. That is what I noticed. By the way, just referring back to what you said a few minutes ago, I think we're nearing the close of this this episode, but. What the BSV fans and the Craig Wright fans do not realize is, of course, it's a civil case. So the judge will look at the evidence and see what evidence makes the most sense and is perceived as genuine. And then he will make up the balance. But how that balance actually works, I only realized, earlier, but today I came across one of my followers. I have several lawyers who follow me, and one of them explained how that works. And allow me to read his tweet. This is just one tweet, and he explained, his name is Bill Smith, he's from America. And what he says, and it works for lying in court, and as far as I can see, this is also considered for the forged evidence. Okay, what he said was, in our line of work, all it takes is one lie. You get caught lying one time, then you have lost all credibility, all of it. This is a principle that keeps our profession in check. It forces attorneys themselves and our clients, our witnesses, and our experts to tread carefully and hopefully act with integrity to guard our reputations. Now, that means that if the judge is looking at Craig Wright, and he finds one forgery that is not being compensated by 500 other half forgeries, or maybe not forgeries, or it could have been genuine evidence. And the same is for the perjury, because we have noticed also a lot of perjury. That means that if he is telling one lie, a lot of things will be on the balance for, yeah, we cannot trust your information when you have given no physical evidence to something that you claim, then we will consider that being a lie because we have caught you lying, not once, probably more than once.
Oh, yes.
And that makes it for me quite clear that Craig has no chance of winning this. There is no genuine evidence. There is a lot of forgeries being caught. His witnesses have no physical evidence. There's nothing left. There's nothing left. So this Bill Smith, he ends with one single line, because the question was, do you think that the judge is believing Craig Wright? And then he answers, no, the judge does not believe him. He is sharpening his knife, patiently waiting to deliver the death blow to this fraudulent carnival barker.
Love it. Well, amen. I think that is the perfect place to leave this. So this is, I think, the 9th episode in total we've done covering the COPA trial. It's been an absolute marathon, but it's been such a pleasure, Arthur, to spend this time with you, hours and hours of your time, going through this extraordinary story. We started this podcast after the lawsuit had been filed, but when it really gathered steam, we started going through our major episodes. And to go from the initial claims to the first Madden report to the LaTeX files to the rest of it, and then to everything we saw on the stand, it's been, I think, as you said, it's been everything we could have hoped for and more. So, yeah, thank you so much for going on this journey with me.
Yeah, no problem. It was more than a pleasure, Mark.
It certainly was. And as for the future, we don't quite know when we'll be back again. Hopefully, there'll be something that happens between now and the verdict, whenever that might be. We won't do an episode covering the closing arguments because we know what they're going to be saying pretty much. And so unless something extraordinary happens between now and the verdict, you will hear from us next after we get the verdict, sometime in many weeks and months down the line. So, Arthur, until that moment, take care of yourself, and I shall speak to you at some point in the future.
Yes, sir. Cheers, man.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Dr. Bitcoin, the man who wasn't Satoshi Nakamoto. Don't forget to subscribe to the show on your podcast platform of choice to get these episodes the moment they drop. And if you enjoyed what you heard, we'd really appreciate a star rating and even a review to help us get this out to as many people as possible. Our monthly bonus episodes are available to download from our website for a small consideration. And if you'd like to access all these bonus episodes, plus these monthly updates a few days early and other goodies, you can do so by becoming a Dr. Bitcoin supporter. See the details in the show notes for information on how to do this, or head to our website, drbitcoinpod.com. That's drbitcoinpod.com. You can also follow us on Twitter at drbitcoinpod, and you can email us at drbitcoinpod@gmail.com. That's drbitcoinpod@gmail.com. Thanks very much for listening, and we'll speak to you again soon.
You've been listening to Dr. Bitcoin, the man who wasn't Satoshi Nakamoto. Written by Mark Hunter, with additional material by Arthur Van Pelt. Editing and production by Mark Hunter. This has been a Contented Media production.